on? Norm Shealy. Norm Shealy. You are listening to Infinite Consciousness, your infinite access to the world
of the mind.
Consciousness tonight, and thanks for listening. Tonight we have with us Paul Helfrich, and we're going to talk about, among other things, his work with the Seth group years ago, back when James Roberts was around. He's got a new book, Seth, the Ultimate God, but he's also got a very interesting paper that's caught my attention about the channeling phenomenon. And many people think that's a very woo-woo thing, and I have to admit that I have at times in my life, even though I do it. But Paul's put a very scientific perspective on it, and I'd like to talk about that a little bit tonight, as well as his work with the Seth material. How are you, Paul?
I'm great, Eva. How are you?
Thanks for coming on my show. I appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure.
So before we get started, why don't you tell people a little bit about you?
Well, I have been an educator for most of my life. I have a background in music. Most of my academic studies were in music. I'm a trained classical composer. I spent 10 years in the science museum business with what's called informal science education, doing museum exhibits, hands-on exhibits, and outreach programs. And I've also spent a number of years studying paranormal phenomena, the channeling phenomenon, integral psychology, and the world's spiritual paths, and in an attempt to try and integrate them all together.
And were you there during some of the original channelings of Seth?
Oh, I wish. No, I was not present at any of what are called the ESP class sessions, where students came in on a weekly basis to interact with Jane Roberts and her channeled entity, Seth.
So how did you get involved with Seth? And the reason that I'm interested in this personally is, you know, when I first came on my journey, it was sudden and spontaneous, but it was Seth, allegedly, that was providing me the information, and I didn't even know who Seth was.
Right.
Or even what channeling was, for that matter. So how did you become interested in Seth and channeling? And
Yeah, that's a great question.
Is it a crazy thing? I mean, are the people that do it crazy?
Oh, absolutely not. But in my case, I grew up in what we can call a secular humanist family. My father was an electrical engineer, so we didn't have a very strong religious indoctrination or upbringing. It was a very scientific and rational household that I grew up in. So I was not exposed to anything paranormal or out of the ordinary in any thorough way. So I was left to my own devices. And so in high school and in early college, I read some of the Carlos Castaneda, the Don Juan series, and some of the shamanic things there, and it piqued my interest at that point in my life. And there was some dream work and other things that Castaneda was talking about with that path. And then when I was 21 years old, a book called Seth Speaks came across my path from my older brother. A friend had given it to him, and I was home on college break, and he said, "Oh, this is the greatest thing since sliced bread. It's got all the answers." And I'm very skeptical, rolling my eyes, and said, "Sure, I'll give it a read." And the next day, I did sit down to read it, and in the opening lines of that book, Seth Speaks, he says, "I don't have a body, and yet I am writing this book. How can that be?" And I'm thinking, "Oh, great, here we go, but I'll give it a chance." And I dove into chapter one, and something happened, because something in the writing was very level-headed and very rational, for lack of a better term, even though it was dealing with paranormal themes. And after an hour and a half of reading it, I had an epiphany sitting there, and somehow this was very meaningful. It was like something was triggered deep inside me, that what I was reading about the human psyche and spiritual ideas connected to it really resonated to me, and I ended up gobbling up that book and thereafter reading everything I could get my hands on with Jane Roberts. So, and I, those books have exercises in them, and I started slowly doing some of the exercises, and over the next 2 or 3 years, this was in the mid-1970s when I started doing this, over the next 2 or 3 years, I started to have some profound psychic experiences that helped me validate the in my own direct experience what was going on in those books. And so the rest is history, so to speak. It led to my deep interest in the Seth material. And then, of course, the channeling phenomenon itself that Jane reflected on in those books and talked about so much, and yet that we know so little about. And so back to your other question, Eva, you know, when someone like Jane Roberts started doing this, she had the same question. Am I crazy? Is there pathology going on here? And her husband, Robert Butts, were very careful to keep an eye on her as she developed this over the first 2 or 3 years. And they looked to conventional allopathic medicine. And what they found there was that they would have labeled her as pathological, that she would have had what is still called some kind of dissociative identity disorder, and that's still in the diagnostic statistic manual used by conventional psychiatry. So that wasn't any help to them as they were getting started. And when she looked to the religious traditions, there was too much superstitious business and ignorance masquerading as informed opinion in some of those areas, the occult areas that she looked into, and she found something that's called glossalia, which is speaking in tongues, that's done in spiritualist churches and even some Baptist churches where it's part of the ceremony and congregational activity. And that was just, okay, that's not good enough for her, speaking in tongues. And because she was speaking in English, and a robust, seemingly fully developed personality was coming through. So you can imagine someone in 1963 and 64 starting to do something like this and wondering, literally, what the hell is going on here? I know I'm not crazy, or I don't think I'm crazy. And so this led to a lifelong path of cooperation with her and her husband and this channeled entity named Seth. And it ended up producing 46 books. Well, Jane did, and many of them were published posthumously after she passed, but 30 of those 46 books are of the Seth material itself, what Seth dictated and what her husband, Rob Butts, took down by hand. There were no computers, and recording technology didn't allow for him to do it quickly. So it's just an incredible sort of very creative phenomena that unfolded for her. And it led to my interest then to wonder about, you know, the channeling phenomenon itself that was recorded so clearly and transparently to the best of their ability in what's now called the Seth phenomenon, of how this was happening. How could this be going on, and what's behind it all, and that conventional science and conventional religion really had such poor answers. So that led to my interest in something that I've been researching for the last 15 years on my own as well.
Well, it sounds like somebody's starting to begin to take it seriously, because you got published in a major medical journal, Journal of Integral Theory and Practice. So somebody must be beginning to think that something's going on, which brings me to ask a question. I remember years ago I interviewed Cassie Veaton at Noetic Sciences, and one of the things that she had complained about was in the Diagnostic Statistical Manual, there were not appropriate diagnostic tools for people who had mystical experiences, but that some people had been, and I can't remember how she put this out there, but that there had somehow came about some kind of test that you had to ask for, ask the doctor specifically to give it to you, if you thought that that was what was happening to you. So do you know if anything with the DSM has changed? Is there any more open-mindedness so that they don't immediately stick a psychotic label or a schizophrenic label on us when we do this, or for people who do this?
I'd have to say yes and no to a degree. I mean, it's a double-edged situation in that the DSM, you know, DSM-5 is due to come out in the next year or so, and they've been working on it for the last decade or so. And, of course, there's a lot riding on what goes in there, because a lot of insurance money and so on and pharmaceutical money gets directed to these diagnoses that are contained in there. They did change the diagnosis to what's now called dissociative identity disorder. I'm forgetting what the name was in DSM 2 or 3 preceding that, but like the term schizophrenia, it's something we still know in the public jargon, but they don't use that term anymore. It's, you know, they're looking at different things. So they would still, see, from conventional thinking, to have any sort of dissociative episode, and let me try to define that for our audience here. A dissociative episode that you can imagine is something like being in a waking dream. When you're in a dream state, you don't have as much control and of your facilities and whatnot. And a good example in waking state of dissociation is when you go into the other room and you forget what you went to go in there to do. That's a very minuscule example of you dissociated from what you were focusing on. You were going to get a screwdriver, to get a postage stamp or something, and you get there and it's like, what did I do? You can't remember. So that's just the dissociation of that kind. When it's extreme, our conventional allopathic medical practitioners still consider that to be pathological. And yet, when you look at the Seth phenomenon, you know, and the creative aspects that are just undeniable, that Jane was a writer and produced her own books, and Rob, her husband, was doing paintings based on the material, and the material itself speaks to over 10 million readers, and it's probably more than that, but that's the general number that we've been using for the last decade with the Seth material. When what comes through is of such high quality, and in fact, the Seth material is considered a gold standard for the modern or even postmodern era from the 1960s forward by scholars on the fringes of the psychology departments in academia. So there is research that's been done, but it's not well funded, and there's generally just not any research grants and money to pursue the kind of research I outlined in my paper, and so on and so forth. But the time has come, the tools are here with the magnetic resonance imaging, the brain scans, in other words, and tools like that to look at brain function and body physiology as well during a channeling session or episode, because it has to do with changing the state, a state change like waking or sleeping. It is a unique state, I believe, and one that can be mapped in terms of brain function that could help us understand it better and develop it better.
Are you aware of any noted material reflecting brain states, such as on an MRI or EEG or anything else, that lets us know where the brain, what's happening in the brain when this is going on?
No.
In other words, is there any proof that, does it happen in a certain place in the brain?
We don't know. That research has not been done. However, on the other side of this, there has been a lot of research done on meditation. So there is a database out there on meditation of Zen monks and yogis and yoginis who've gone into the laboratory and had their brain mapped in meditative states. And there are some areas in the cerebral cortex, the uniquely human part of the mammalian brain, that they've identified. And there's even, I mean, you could probably Google the term God spot in terms of neuroscience and brain research. And there's some areas that light up during deep meditation and these experiences of what's called mystical union, which is sort of one of the highest forms of meditation practice. So there is a database, and there are decades of research in the meditation area that have been done, and medical science knows the benefits of meditation just in terms of relaxation and lowering stress, lowering blood pressure, heart rate, circulatory system function and whatnot to help people in our stressful times. So there is research on that, but the channeling phenomenon is so rare and misunderstood and underground. It's been forced underground, as I came to understand as I researched it, because most people don't don't go broadcasting this sort of thing. It's not something you see on your local news with any frequency whatsoever.
Yeah, you get locked up in a mental hospital if you
do. That's right.
So hey, let me ask you this. Do you believe that this is something that can be done at will at any given moment, or do you think that you have to go into an altered state?
Well, it's both. I think in its mature form, channeling is engaged and disengaged at will. And that is a healthy definition of channeling as a state, you know, like waking state and sleeping state. If we, as it needs to be defined, I believe, as a state as well, because we'll find characteristics, physiological characteristics, not just in the brain, but in breathing, circulatory systems, hormone production, release, and whatever, that it needs to be defined that way as well.
Now, there's a sentence in your in this paper that you wrote on your page, which I'm going to just, let me scroll it to the top so I can tell people what the name of it is. It's on your website, paulhelfrich.com, paulhelfrich.com, and it's called the channeling phenomenon. Now, let me get back to this state, this statement. Could there be a natural disassociative intelligence that has been forced underground, blah, blah, blah? Now, my question is, do you think that we are channeling something, because I do this, that's in our head? Or do you think that we're actually getting it from an outside source? Because I know, in my instance and in Jane's instance, that we provide information that we knew nothing about. For example, in quantum mechanics, consciousness units, you know. What do you think that is? Where is that some outside source, or is that us, or how do you describe that?
It's a combination of both, actually. And if we just back up a step, and the model that I use to try and explain this is that of an iceberg, an analogy of the iceberg. If the tip of the iceberg represents our physiology, the physically quantum manifest physical stuff of the universe, including our brain and body system, the submerged part of the iceberg, it represents the soul, the spectrum into soul and spirit. And these are non-physical, and we can't measure them with any of the stuff made from the tip of the iceberg. The only way to access them and study them and engage them is through our mental or psychological bridging states. And so if we use that model of the iceberg, a channeler is engaging in altered state and tapping into something in the submerged part of the iceberg universe. So not only are individuals of an iceberg nature, but the entire quantum universe is of an iceberg nature, in that any quantum matter from the dust in a nebula, that's a good example because it's the most basic stuff in physical terms. If we just take a hydrogen atom or cloud in a nebula, that has a tip of the iceberg nature, but it's also connected to a non-physical source domain and has characteristics there that it's connected to that are invisible to us in our conventional sciences right now. So when you're channeling, then you're using the physical stuff of your body, so it's in your head, so to speak, in terms of the tip of the iceberg. But then the question then that you're getting into is, does Seth or any other entity that we want to put a name on have an autonomous existence separate from Eva or Jane or Paul or whomever? And according to Jane's research and her experience, the answer is yes. And according to my experience and research, the answer is yes, that we'll just take the Seth persona for now, has an autonomous psychological existence somewhere in the submerged part of the iceberg universe that we are tapping into in some kind of mergence, some kind of, people are familiar with the law of attraction, and that's in terms of physics, actually opposites attract. But in terms of psychology, similar birds of a feather are drawn together. And in psychological terms, a Seth-type entity has an intention about it, as do all human beings in terms of their iceberg nature. And so that attracts it to itself, and some kind of mergence or energy exchange occurs. And this is how we model it anyway and try to explain it, that So it's inside our head, but it has an autonomous existence. It's not really outside of us in terms of the physical tips of the iceberg universe stuff, but inside the submerged part of this iceberg universe, consciousness is much more merged together, and yet there are distinctions that can be made. There's different personality tones, and Seth used, what was the term? He used a non-physical energy personality essence to try and describe his submerged part of the iceberg self that he identified with.
Do you believe, and I don't tell people this, certainly not on my radio show, but I'm going to. I have channeled two entities, one who identifies itself as Michael and one who identifies itself as Seth. And I find that they have two distinct personalities, use two distinct structures of language, and discuss or provide information on two distinctly different topics. Do you have anything to talk about that?
Well, what's interesting about that is from your own experience with those and identifying what we could just call, generally speaking, their personality tones, what you were just describing as effects or artifacts of their unique personality tones shows they have a unique way of using language as they merge with your consciousness and use your linguistic database, so to speak, of how you use language to come through you and express themselves through you. They do that in unique ways, and you can feel that, and we can see that. If we read what they've written, we can start to feel a different personality, and if we were present to observe you channeling and doing that, odds are that vocal mannerisms or facial expression and other personality traits would be unique as well. And then, of course, the skeptic will raise the issue of pathology and say, well, we know about Sybil and split personality and so on. And we're not denying that. That is a pathological condition where the main aspect self fragments. It's not whole, and it does split. So this, I'm not talking about situations where different personalities come in unknown to the main personality. What we're talking about in its healthy form here, as I know it and understand it, is where other personalities come in, and generally speaking, they give very useful information, and information unknown to the main or let's call it waking personality, but it is the main personality, and it is that personality's job, and another term for it is ego. We use ego or outer ego. The job is to bind all of the psychological elements in the iceberg self smoothly together so that it functions, that its hygiene is good, that it's resting good, that its behavior is socially acceptable and so on and so forth. So we're not talking about a situation of split personality that's pathological that needs to be healed and integrate those aspects together so that the main personality is whole again. Typically what I have found is that channelers need to have a very strong ego and centered sense before they engage something at the quality of the Seth material, and there's dozens of others of high quality as well that are with us today that we know about. So
why have you put any thought into why an outside personality, I don't know what to call it, you probably have better language, would choose, like, when Seth talks to me, it's more like things about the laws of the universe. When Michael talks to me, it's more about population control and humanitarian things. Why or how a particular source would choose the topics, and why or how the source would choose a particular individual to convey particular information? Does that make any sense?
Yes, these are great questions, and it's subtle and nuanced, a proper answer. So I'll try and build this up, but if we back up a step again, from this submerged part of the iceberg self, and the human being a very important, highly developed evolutionary expression of that self in the physical world, physical universe, the submerged part that we can, let's just call it the soul realm for now. The soul realm itself has some kind of innate intention behind it. And our universe was not just randomly formed by chance, which is the sort of major story we get if you watch the Science Channel or Discovery Channel or Learning Channel. When you watch typical mainstream science shows, they project that sort of thing. But this innate intentionality goes very, very deep, and it was there in what Seth calls before the beginning, in a non-physical sense, before our universe, before the Big Bang, let's call it. And after the Big Bang, in the beginning, there was an innate intention at work then, from the very nanosecond after the Big Bang, pushing the evolutionary forces in terms of the quantum processes that were unfolding billions of years ago at that time as we understand it. So there's an innate intention to the consciousness that creates all of our reality. And this is another, truth that I hold to be self-evident at this point, that consciousness is primary and comes first, and it creates all physical matter. It creates the tip of the iceberg. The submerged portion pre-exists in an eternal sort of way, and it's difficult to put into physical.
Let me stop you for just a moment.
Sure.
One thing that I've found in interviews is that when people use that word consciousness, I'll ask 30 people what that word means to them, and I get 30 definitions. So what do you mean by that word?
Consciousness with a capital C is how I'm defining that word. So it's a primal cause. You could use the term God. You could use the term all that is. You could use the term Buddha mind, the Tao, the source field. There's other, the Akasha. There's other terms that are bandied about. But it's conscious. It's the primal consciousness with a capital C is what I'm referring to. That's eternal, ineffable, omnipresent, omniscient, omnipotent, presupposes all physical construction and all okay. attempts to try and define it. So it's a somewhat Eastern definition, perhaps, that I'm using right now. But so as the one turns into the many, and the many create this evolutionary path in physical terms, there's an innate intention in the source selves, the soul realm, driving this. So this Michael personality that you're familiar with, this Seth personality that you're familiar with, has its own innate intention, as does Eva's soul self, and as does mine. Now, Eva, the personality in the physical world, also has an innate intention because you're connected to the soul realm. How we discover that and get in tune with that is a key to our health and leading productive, fulfilling, abundant lives. So this is a long answer to your question, but therefore you have an innate intent, physically speaking. This Michael and Seth personality, soul, essence, tone has their own intent, and there is some kind of law of attraction at work that is a match that works together and that draws them to you and you to them, and an agreement occurs at the soul level for this to unfold. Because you could probably confirm this, Eva, that in your own experience, you don't remember, physically saying, okay, I'm going to allow this to happen in the next 10 minutes, or tomorrow morning I'm going to start channeling. All of a sudden, this thing unfolds in your consciousness, and you're wondering what the heck is going on.
That's exactly what happened. I mean, I didn't even know this stuff existed. I thought I was going crazy.
Right.
But one thing I have found, and before I say this, because I don't want to forget it, I want to talk about nutrition and schizophrenia and Abram Hoffer in a few minutes when we get through, so don't even forget that.
Okay.
But one thing I have found when I talk to people who have this ability, an at-will ability to do this, they've all been through what I call a really dark night of the soul, where something bad has happened to their lives to basically, put their nose on the pavement.
Right.
And wake them up. Do you think there's... Does that make any sense? Do you think there's any connection with that?
Oh, very much. Very much so. That and again, to back up a layer and just try to get my narrative out there, that we live in a very materialistic age, and in the course of our human evolution, that is actually billions of years old, our trajectory. We didn't just pop in randomly. But in that trajectory of our evolution, we live in a very materialist galactic time. So we're very disconnected from the soul realm. In fact, probably a third of humanity, of the 7 billion of us, don't even believe they have a soul or don't believe that there's an afterlife right now. And that's a symptom of that. So these dark nights of the soul are ways of getting our attention, ways of waking us up to the reality of this inner realm. And unfortunately, this dark night of the soul phenomenon, an example of that is what's called a near-death experience, where people have a heart attack, they're in a car accident, they drug overdose, suddenly they're out of body, looking down at their body in the hospital. Some kind of severe trauma has happened. And they come back from that trauma with this experience of their of the soul realm and their soul body or astral body, and suddenly, and you can tell when you hear the reports of these people, they speak with a self-evident truth certainty, and you cannot convince them otherwise. And for the most part, they seem to be very normal people. They're not crazy or what we would consider mentally unbalanced. And so they speak with a certainty from that experience. So yes, the dark night of the soul experience is a way of forcing us to attend to something we may have intended to look at in this lifetime, but because of the nature of our cultural belief systems and the gravity of our mass beliefs, again, perhaps a third of the population do not even believe in a soul. This is one way that our inner self gets our attention and pushes, you know, in a very, very dramatic way, you know, that you can no longer ignore it. You know, and typically leading up to that dark night of the soul, there were little tremors, little precursor experiences, but the waking personality still just, no, I'm not going to pay attention to that. I don't believe in that. Or there's too much pressure to think about that. I can't go out of the norm. My minister's telling me I'll go to hell if I think about that, or they'll tell me I'm crazy. You know, and so there's these very strong belief systems that keep us locked in. So, yeah, the dark night of the soul is a very important part of the whole journey that we're on.
So my next question is, you know, if you go to a psychologist or a psychiatrist, let's say you go because you're having depression, has nothing to do with your channeling thing, but they start asking you questions, do you hear voices? Well, yeah, you hear this voice, but how do you describe that to the psychiatrist? You know, he's going to immediately label you schizophrenic.
Mm-hmm.
And hold on one second. So Abram Hoffer, I don't know if you're familiar with his work, but Abram Hoffer has established that people who are schizophrenic are niacin deficient. So he gives them niacin and that chattering. And it's usually a different kind of chattering, calling your name over and over, or, you know, telling you some to hurt yourself or hurt somebody. It's usually different. So do you think there's a possibility, and I don't think so myself, but I'm asking for my listening audience, do you think there's a possibility of some nutritional deficiency?
I think that's a legitimate phenomenon, something we can't ignore or cast out in any sort of way. And what you're describing, again, points to what I would put in the pathological category as a type of pathology, where it's an obsessive compulsive repeating of that voice in the head, that it's not providing you healthy information or helpful information. It's sort of being on a hamster wheel in that sort of obsessive compulsive area of our psychology, and therefore nutrition and other things can help change our hormonal balance and bring us back. You know, even some of the drugs that they use for that will stop that altogether. And on just the scientist in me would love to see some experiments with confirmed channelers on some of the different drugs that they use and what those effects would be on their sources and their channeling state. I think we'd be amazed in some cases that there will be things where it doesn't change anything at all.
Well, I can tell you from my own experience, because when this happened to me, I literally checked myself into a psychiatric hospital because it came out of nowhere, and I thought I was going crazy. You know, how did I suddenly know all of this information? And they, of course, if you do that, they're going to immediately put you on 7 or 8, if not more, psychotropic drugs or some kind of drugs. And no matter what they put me on, it did not change the receiving of this information.
That's an interesting data point then for me, too, because that shows that in your psychological and physiological makeup, that something had evolved and developed to the point where something opened. And if we think of our body-mind use another analogy of just a radio receiver of different frequencies, suddenly your body-mind was open to a new set of frequencies that just happened to have personality tones attached to them, you know, full-blown personality tones communicating with information.
And just, I know that engineers have a problem with that word of frequency, but I think you really, and I use it like you do because I'm not an engineer or a scientist, but I think you mean resonance, right?
No, I mean frequency.
In what respect? You mean hertz?
Yeah, in terms of hertz, the electromagnetic spectrum, absolutely. Mm-hmm. There's its counterparts. There has to be some kind of non-physical counterpart spectrum that, let's just say, goes into the negative numbers. You know, we don't have negative hertz. We don't use negative numbers for that. Mm-hmm. We just go to zero and it's zeroed out. But if you go into that underside and the concept of multiplexing, you know, where multiple signals get nested within a sine wave as a carrier wave, that a larger wave carries it, but other waves get nested inside. So it's a very complex waveform. So if we're using these, and I'll say I'm using them as analogies because I don't have the empirical evidence to back up my statements, of course, in this regard, but just my own experience, ballparks, that these are the places that I would begin my research in.
Okay, so let's talk about your book a little bit. I could talk about this for the rest of the night, but I do want to bring your book to the attention of my audience. What is important about this? We're going to talk about your book, Seth, the Ultimate God. What is important about the Seth material? Why would it be important to someone? How would this material benefit their lives?
In the most general way, it provides a map, a very comprehensive and detailed map of consciousness, and it provides a series of beginning exercises to begin to test out the waters directly through your own direct experience. And so it serves as a foundation for people to understand what Seth called, or coined the term, actually, you create your own reality. How does reality creation work then? How do I create my own reality? How do we jointly co-create our realities? Well, collective co-creation is very complicated, as we know, from economics and military and political situations. So Seth concentrated on individual reality creation. And so when we look at individual reality creation, there's four general bands of information in the Seth material. One is the physics of reality creation. Second is the biology, the biological level, cellular level of reality creation. Third is the psychological level, which is one of the most important ones. And then the fourth is the metaphysical or philosophical, things that we can't prove. But within those four domains, the Seth material provides ample information to explore how you create your own reality. And then once you get the basics down for that, you can apply that to anything in your life, whether it's abundance issues, money issues, whether it's relationship issues, whether it's health issues. So we don't use the material to, in that specific way, to just say, you know, get rich quick and use the Seth material. If you want to get rich, and you can study the Seth material and learn business belief systems and find out how to make all the money in the world. If you want to find your soulmate, the love of your life, if you want to deal with a disease, some kind of a personal health issue, and you can heal yourself of almost anything, it's not 100%, but according to Seth, when we identify the core belief systems involved in our health issues, we can heal ourselves. And that our human body is innately designed to maintain a healthy equilibrium. Now, of course, on a larger scale, then you say, well, yes, well, what about suicides and so-called birth defects and so-called other diseases that strike people down, like Stephen Hawking, the famous physicist, and his degenerative immune disease that he has, and so on. Well, what about that? Well, Seth does bring meaning and purpose to all of those things in a general way. So we will you have to look at each individual situation on a case-by-case basis. I try to refrain from making generalizations about any particular relationship issue, health issue, you know, money issue, political issue, until you have specifics with specific people, their specific history, and you can start to dig under the submerged part of the iceberg self. And from that Sethian perspective, he very skillfully shows that there's always a meaning and a purpose to everything that we create. So,
do you believe that, the expanse of or your vocabulary is important? In other words, are you limited to your vocabulary? Let's say somebody does want to learn about money. They want to know which stock to pick, for example. It's my own personal opinion, and you feel free to go where you want to go with this, that in order to know which stock to pick, I would have to have every name of every stock in existence in my vocabulary to be able to know how to choose those words. So do you believe vocabulary is important? Or if you wanted to do a medical intuitive or medical diagnosis, you would have to have those words in your vocabulary to be able to choose from them. In my perspective.
Yes. Yeah, it's a little bit apples and oranges, so I just, you know, because you used two different examples there. One is picking stocks, and one is intuitive medical diagnosis. They're a little bit different. But vocabulary applies to both of them and how you use that. Let's just go to stocks for a moment. What we're dealing with here, again, I would have to go into a person's situation, their background, and looking at their belief systems in detail about money, their family environment that they grew up in, and the beliefs that they have about abundance and scarcity. Because a lot of people sabotage their own success, as you know, health-wise and even abundance-wise and even relationship-wise. And they're doing it subconsciously, and that's where the belief work is very important. But vocabulary-wise, I think the belief work is much more important in terms of picking stocks or actually running a bit. I like to use the example of just becoming an entrepreneur and creating your own small business, not a get-rich-quick thing of give me the lottery number, divine a lottery number, or divine a stock portfolio. I've got $80,000 and I want to turn it into $500,000 in 6 months. I mean, that's something that can be done, but you're really, you know, playing high-stakes poker, gambling in a sense, and that's a whole area in and of itself. But another part of this is just basic belief systems, forming a business belief systems, forming a business, knowing how to build a business and provide a product and service that's useful and get cash flow going and run a business. Onto the medical intuitive part of this, the vocabulary would play a more significant role, in my opinion, particularly if you're trying to come up with diagnoses that can be used in conventional or even alternative medical circles. So the vocabulary is an important thing. And an interesting side jump over back to Jane Roberts and Seth. Seth made a point of saying he picked Jane, or why Jane was so important in their relationship, because she wasn't a trained scientist. Her scientific vocabulary wasn't overly specialized or biased in one particular area. As an engineer, there's many different kinds of engineering and vocabularies that go with that. And so her information comes out in a general vocabulary for the general public. But in terms of being a medical intuitive, for you to connect with the medical establishment, you need to relate to them and have certain terms. So you've got to build a bridge across that conceptual gap, and yet medical intuitives are tapping into things, but things then can get distorted in the translation of the intuition. If we just call it a deep intuition for a moment, of where you're working with, let's just say, a client as a medical intuitive, and you're getting impressions from them, and you can feel something in their liver area or digestive area or their circulatory system or their lung or their brain area, and yet you've got to put that into terms that's meaningful and helpful. So in that situation, vocabulary, I think, would be even more important. And yet, you know, they say spirit works in mysterious ways, right? So why someone with a simpler vocabulary has a deeper skill, you know, and you're familiar with Edgar Cayce, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he was someone who wasn't a studied medical professional at all, and yet has tens of thousands of medical diagnoses in the records and archives there in Virginia in his legacy institution.
So let's talk a minute about, in your book, you talk about the non-families of consciousness. What do you mean by that?
One of my favorite.
And what is the importance of that?
One of my favorite topics. Thanks for bringing that up. That gets back to this innate intention within the soul realm that there are nine complementary forms of consciousness that underlie our physical universe and all human expressions within it. So all human beings belong to one of those nine families of consciousness. And Seth used the families metaphor because it's one of our most beautiful and cherished and functional social structures so that we can all relate to it, hopefully, with a pleasant feeling about family and being close to it and being something important rather than a more generic typing term. But these families were involved in the creation of the universe in Seth's creation myth, and they play a very, very important role. They are also known in esoteric Christianity as the nine spiritual hierarchies. So this is something, if this is real, and this is a question I ask myself every few years as I'm going through all of this material and my studies with it, you know, if this is real, then through the centuries and the millennia, it has to have been intuited, divined, and understood by various people, human beings, and translated over the centuries. And so this is something that is a really important part of the Seth material, but not very well known. And I guess, so what I would want people to think about, if you take one thing away from the nine families, is that you have an innate intention in this life. And for example, of the nine families, one of the families are nurturers. They're the ones that give birth to a healthy earth stock. They're the super parents of the nine. Another one are the artists. Another one are the body imagers that use their bodies as expression. So the athletes, the tattooed empirist people who use their body as an expression of art, is a third one. There are the reformers who reform the status quo. So there's this innate, you know, contrariness to some of us that just no matter how conservative we want to maintain the status quo, there are people who are just going to be contrary and protest and stir the pot. There are the teachers, let's just call them that. They deal with low distortion of information and knowledge. So these are the librarians and the teachers that are out there teaching our children in many cases, and so on and so forth. So each of these, as you get a sense of their function, these nine complement each other and build a functional template or blueprint for all human civilizations to emerge in all of their different variations.
One of the most fascinating things and important things that I personally got from the Seth material was the consciousness unit. Can you talk about that for a few minutes? What is that thing and why is it important?
Yes, this fits into the physics of reality creation. Seth used that metaphor of consciousness units, or CUs for short, to explain a fundamental causal unit of consciousness. And if I refer back to my early comments of defining that consciousness with a capital C as primal cause, then that one, the one, as it fragmented into the many, these consciousness units were at the very basis of that fragmentation or emanation into the many, of which we all are. And so these consciousness units then are part of the submerged part of the iceberg universe that are aware of each other and aware of every grouping that they've ever had with each other. And according to Seth, he says there's many millions of them in a single atomic structure, so that they are much smaller. But he took a particular particle wave in terms of the particle wave duality. a sort of a building block. He tried to explain this metaphor as a building block. These consciousness units build up together in intensity, and then as they become closer to physical manifestation, he used a second state that they function in, and he called those electromagnetic energy units. And they're superluminal, meaning they're faster than the speed of light, but they're incipient matter, a form of incipient matter. As consciousness is projecting itself into the physical domain, it goes through another transformative stage that he just called electromagnetic energy units. And then we could add to that the quantum field. So if we have this chain of consciousness unit, electromagnetic energy unit, and quantum field represents the tip of the iceberg universe. This EE and CU metaphor is his attempt to explain the causal forces of consciousness as no thing, consciousness is no thing, creates something in physical terms. And it's quite a mystery how that actually works. But it's one of his important metaphors that he used to try and explain that.
We've got about 10 minutes. I want to ask one question, but keep in mind that I also want you to, after you answer this question, to talk about anything that you want to talk about, because there's a million things in your book to talk about. But I wanted to ask you about master events. And then after you answer that question, if we have any time, please take that time to talk about anything you want to talk about.
Great, thank you. Seth introduced this concept of master events to try and explain collective reality creation in the soul realm. So in the submerged part of the iceberg self, you know, when you look at an iceberg model of the universe, you have to wonder how the submerged part, how the soul realm is functioning. How is it working? What are its physics? What are its psychology? What's its, you know, soul biology and so on. So he used the term master events as what's happening in these nine families of consciousness with us at the soul level to fuel. It serves as a kind of soul fuel that actually becomes physically manifest through these CUs, EE, quantum field physics of sorts into the physical world. And an example of a master event, he said, of course, is the creation of your universe. That's a master event that was dealt with in the soul realm. And then also the Christ, what he calls the Christ drama, was also a master event. So the creation of the Christian religion and its unfolding over the last 2,000 years is another master event. And there's a lot of material on the Christ drama in the Seth material as well, in Seth Speaks in particular, for anyone interested in looking that up. And so master events are, the final thought on that, are how we collectively co-create our reality together within the soul realm, and then as it trickles through into physical reality. So everything that's going on today, our wars, our economic recession, our harmonics or overtones or ripples from deeper, deeper, deeper collective master events, the direction that our civilization is taking with its technologies, the world wars we had in the last century, the wars that we're still in are symptoms of our general evolutionary state of consciousness, and we're changing. We're in a continuum that's continuing to refine itself, and so master events play an important part in that. And to move on to just one thing I would like to mention to your audience tonight, too, is that we have a website, if you're interested in learning more about this, that's called newworldview.com, newworldview.com, and we have an online course that we run three times a year. We use a academic model. Actually, there's a spring semester that starts February 21st, and there's a summer session that starts in June, and a fall semester that begins in September and ends in November of every year. And we have an online course that's called Seth Revealed, Unlock the Secrets of Conscious Creation, and it covers all of the material in my book. And I should also add the caveat that my book is not publicly available yet, so there are legal restraints on it being able to be publicly available, but we are able to offer it in booklet form as part of this online course that we're teaching. And we've had students, we have over 20 students. We just started this past summer, and we have students from all around the world, Australia, Japan, Netherlands, Germany, UK, Canada, and the United States. So we're very excited about that, and I teach that with my wife, Joanne Helfrich, and our good friend, Chris Johnson, in the UK. So there's multiple teachers in that class. And check out the website, newworldview.com, if you're interested, and send me any questions you might have. Like us on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter as well. We're running a series of tweets and things on Facebook that are articulating some of the general themes in the book and in the course in a serial form that you can follow. If you're interested.
Anything else? We've got about 5 minutes. Anything else you think's important that we've left out?
Oh, geez, there's so much to cover, as you know. But
I know.
just one more comment generally about the way that I have researched the Seth material and organized it, and it's working very well, as we've learned from the classes that we're teaching, is that we approach it in three general zones, and our self, looking at the self, looking at our world, and then the third segment is how we all get along, or the ethical or moral component of reality creation. And Seth very much talked about that. In fact, Seth said that the CUs themselves have an ethical component in them, which means that God itself in its primal form has an inherent moral ethical condition to it that gets expressed throughout itself. And of course, the skeptics will say, how can there be a God if, you know, the Holocaust, Auschwitz, the Nazi Holocaust, and so on? How can evil exist if there's a, how can God allow that to happen? Well, it's a very subtle and nuanced and important philosophical question, one that takes a little bit more time than we have today to answer. But Seth has a very strong answer to that, and we use these three general zones, yourself, your world, and how we can all get along, to really synergize the different parts of the Seth material to create a very strong foundation so that you can go forward and apply it to whatever area of your life you need to.
Does Seth have anything to do with religion?
Yes and no. The Seth material is not a religion. He specifically said he did not want to create a new religion based upon it. It is what we generally make a distinction then use the term spirituality. It is about human spirituality. It does talk about reincarnation and karma and other related concepts. So I would use the label, it's more in the area of human spirituality, because there's no central organization, there's no pope, it's person-centered, it really focuses on the individual and resists any large-scale organization using to make it a dogma or a philosophy in and of itself.
So we've got just a minute or two. Why don't you tell people again where they can find you? And you've written other materials as well where they might find that as well.
Yes, thank you. You can join us on newworldview.com and look for our online course, Seth Revealed, Unlock the Secrets of Conscious Creation. We'd love it if you join us on Facebook, and that would be facebook.com/newworldview, and on Twitter, /newworldview1. Follow us there. And any questions you might have, our email address is there. It's helfrich@newworldview.com. Please feel free to email me with any questions you might have about anything we're doing. And if you're interested in our online course, the early bird registration ends on February 7th, so you have plenty of time to check that out.
And what is some of the other work that you've done, and where is that posted on there as well, or is it on your personal site?
The Seth-related and conscious creation work is on New World View. The personal work that I've done is on my personal website, paulhelfrich.com, under publications, and there's essays, and there's videos of my talks and presentations. There's hours and hours of material, free stuff there for anybody to check out.
If you don't mind, if you would spell your name for them, just
sure.
Make sure.
PAULHELFRICH.com.
Thank you so much, Paul. This hour flew by. I mean, I could ask you probably 1,000 more questions. There's not enough time, but thank you so much for taking the time to come on my show.
Thank you for having me, Eva.
Have a good evening and a happy holidays.
And the same to you and yours.
Good night.
All right, bye now.